American Portraits, a feature series presented by the National Broadcasting Company. American Portraits, brief dramatized biographies. A series picturing its subject as the human men and women they were, with their honest faults as well as their heroic virtues. Our portrait tonight is of Thomas Jefferson. Our narrator, Graham McNamee.
On a stormy night in 1772, farmers along the road to Monticello witnessed the quaint sight of a young man of 29 and a laughing, bright-eyed young woman riding a single horse at a gallop through snowdrifts, which made that winter a memorable one in Virginia. This was the brilliant young attorney, Thomas Jefferson, bringing his bride home to the single-room house, which was the beginning of the famous Monticello mansion of later years. They drew up before the door, entered the house, only to find
hardly a warm welcome for a bride, Martha.
Oh.
The fire's out, servants down at their quarters.
Oh, but how much nicer to have our homecoming all to ourselves.
If the carriage hadn't broken down, still, this makes it an adventure, doesn't it?
A glorious adventure, Thomas. I wouldn't have it otherwise.
The first thing to do is get the fire going, take the chill out of the room.
Can an attorney build a fire?
Well, if he can't, now's the time to learn.
Well, let's see.
Here's some kindling.
Oh.
Some good, sturdy logs.
Splendid.
Now then, what do we say to that?
We say bravo. You're as good a fire maker as a lawyer.
You're rather plain little abode to offer a lady of wealth.
It's charming, Thomas.
Of course, this isn't the entire house. Foundations are laid for several other rooms, but this is the only room completed so far.
Someday it will be the most beautiful house in Virginia, judging from the plans you showed me.
I hope so, my dear. It's to be your home. We'll be building it together for years to come, I dare say. Look through the window.
Hmm?
Isn't that a view to grow and grow on you?
It's perfect, Thomas. See how the snow is heaped up on the branches of the trees. Oh, the whole place is a fairyland.
Yes, even if a cold one at the moment. Here's something that will help warm us.
What is it?
A half bottle of wine.
Oh, splendid.
Just the thing to take the chill off. Here, my dear.
Thank you. We'll drink a toast to each other.
Yes.
To a long life for both of us. A celebrated one for you. A happy one for all of us here at beautiful Monticello.
You couldn't have wished us better, Martha. Poor hospitality, but cheering. Let's sit here before the fire a moment, before I go out and take care of that faithful animal that carried us up here.
Oh, my. Oh, it is cozy here. Homelike, Thomas.
Someday.
Ever so homelike.
Someday there'll be a handsome drawing room. A large, comfortable dining room.
And a music room, perhaps, where we can play together?
By all means. After all, my violin is all that's left from the Shadwell fire.
You poor darling. Losing all your favorite books and all your papers.
We'll bring up a harpsichord for you from Williamsburg. What times we'll have playing music together.
Oh, Thomas, it's going to be perfect. Simply perfect.
And it was a perfect life for Thomas and Martha Jefferson during those first years at Monticello. He was a gifted attorney and a careful manager of his estates, which combined with his wife's comprised 5,000 acres. She was a charming hostess, a devoted wife and mother who enjoyed to the utmost the expansion of the house and the gardens surrounding it. But Jefferson was frequently to be called away from this charmed existence to take his destined place in public affairs.
1770, Thomas Jefferson becomes a member of the Virginia House of Burgesses.
1774, Jefferson publishes his Summary View of the Rights of British America, Attacking British Taxes.
1775.
Jefferson succeeds Randolph in the Continental Congress.
1776, Jefferson is elected to draft a Declaration of American Independence.
He was now only 33 years old, but already his power with the written word had made him famous. He was appointed to a committee, including Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, to draw up the document. Already there existed deep admiration and friendship between Adams and Jefferson.
But, John Adams, it appears to me that you were the logical one to draft this document. I am the youngest member of the committee, and I
only seven or eight years younger than I, Jefferson. Age means nothing in this matter. You're thoroughly familiar with all the points of controversy, and you have magic in your pen. Furthermore, I feel it's more appropriate for a Virginian to draft the declaration, since Richard Henry Lee is the one who introduced the resolution calling for it.
It's a great honor, I realize, to be trusted by you and Mr. Franklin and the others to write the draft. Still, I...
All that's necessary is to embody the spirit and the purpose of Lee's resolution. That these colonies are, and of a right ought to be, free and independent states.
Yes, and that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown. But there are broader aspects of a decision to be a free people, Adams. It's not going to be a simple matter.
No one realizes that more than I. But you're capable of the task, Jefferson. Throw yourself into it. Backed by the passion of a people demanding liberty, you can't fail.
I shall do my utmost, you may be certain of that. When I've completed the draft, I should like to get your opinion of it before it's submitted to our committee and Congress.
Retiring to a brick house in Market Street where he had taken lodgings, young Jefferson set to work composing the phrases that were to shake the world.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men... No, there must be a more general opening, more in the nature of a prologue, leading up to, when it becomes necessary for one people, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, now we have it. And to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature... Now, that's better. Now we can declare more after that preliminary paragraph. Now we can say, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are entitled to life, liberty, no, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
You've done a splendid piece of work here, Jefferson. There are flights of real poetic expression, and there's a lofty, high-minded quality, which is admirable.
You approve of it, then, as it stands, Adams?
Well, there are a few phrases that seem to me to lack the dignity of the rest. Perhaps the fairness, too.
Which are they? Perhaps I can improve them.
Well, let me see. It's where you go into our grievances. Your facts are correct, but the expression... Now, here, for example... The paragraph where you summarize after taking up particular points. You say, in every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury.
Well, it's the truth, Adams. You know as well as I.
No, just a minute. Here's the passage. A prince, you say, referring to King George, of course, a prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant, is unfit to be the ruler of a free people.
And you quarrel with that?
Only in a personal way, Jefferson. I don't feel George III is a tyrant in his own nature, but a monarch misled by his advisers.
I see. I fear I can't honestly perceive the fine shade of difference.
Well, it's merely my personal estimate. I shouldn't care to insist on a revision without first getting the reaction of Franklin and the others of the committee.
Well, that's entirely fair.
Now, Franklin may suggest a change or two, but on the whole, Jefferson, I think you've done a remarkably fine piece of work. I couldn't have done it myself. I haven't your magic of expression. And I'll venture to predict that your unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America will go down in history as a great and a noble document.
John Adams and Benjamin Franklin both made certain changes in the draft. A fresh copy was made by Jefferson, reported to the committee, and brought up before Congress. For 3 days, the document was debated, Jefferson stirring uneasily in his seat beside Franklin as a few more changes were made. Then the Declaration of Independence was unanimously passed on July 4th and signed by John Hancock. Soon it was being read in the public squares up and down the land.
We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be dissolved, and that as free and independent states...
During the war, Jefferson's energies were directed chiefly toward aiding his native Commonwealth, Virginia, in meeting the exigencies that presented themselves. As a member of the House of Delegates, he further increased his importance to his state, and in 1779 he was chosen to succeed Patrick Henry as governor. He assumed office at a critical time. The brunt of the war was now being felt in the South. Jefferson found his state almost without funds and unprepared to take up the war at close quarters. Georgia was subdued. Charleston fell. And soon Richmond heard startling news.
I don't like it.
They'll be on us any day, any hour.
A fleet has entered the Virginia Cape.
I heard that Benedict Arnold was with the fleet.
Well, General Arnold?
If that's true, he's turned traitor.
They say he's at the head of almost 2,000 men.
The hour has come. Virginia must fight for her life.
Governor Jefferson at once ordered out the militia. The enemy was within 25 miles of Richmond. Adjourning the legislature hurriedly and instructing its members to carry orders to their home localities, Jefferson himself took to his horse to oversee the removal of public and state stores to a place of safety across the river. He rode so furiously that near a farmhouse opposite the city...
Now, old boy, easy. Easy. Oh, you're stumbling. Well, the poor animal, ridden to death. Perhaps at that farmhouse there I can find another horse. I've had an accident. My horse...
The Lord bless us. It's the governor carrying a saddle.
Have you a horse I can use? It's a matter of greatest urgency to all of us.
Well, sir, come right on out to the barn. I dare say we can find a good animal for you.
Jefferson rode on, observing the occupation of Richmond across the river. Doing what he could to see that the public stores were saved, he rode on to issue personally the orders which were to institute Virginia's defense. Later, the war came home to him personally. He and his family escaped with their lives when Tarleton raided Monticello. But the cruelties of the war and its hardships undermined the declining health of Martha Jefferson, and she died a few weeks before the provisional peace brought hostilities to an end.
But Jefferson was not permitted by his country to retire and grieve. He was soon back in the struggle of a new nation to set up permanent self-government.
1783, Jefferson elected again to Congress.
1785, Jefferson succeeds Franklin as minister to France.
1789, Washington appoints Jefferson Secretary of State.
Mr. President, Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Hamilton to see you, sir.
Jefferson,
yes, sir. Mr. Washington will see you, gentlemen.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Good day, gentlemen. Please be seated.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. President.
Yes, Mr. Jefferson?
I fear I shall be obliged to tender my resignation from the post of Secretary of State.
Indeed. I am grieved to hear that.
There can be no real consolidated strength in your administration while there is dissension within it.
That is entirely true, Mr. Secretary.
A certain attack has appeared in the public prints. I am the subject of the attack. I think Mr. Hamilton understands why I should feel as I do.
Are you stating, Mr. Jefferson, that I am the author of the attack?
I'm stating nothing. Whether you yourself wrote it or not, the fact remains that its context is entirely in harmony with your opinion of my position.
Now, gentlemen, I must ask you to contain your passions. This is not the first time I have listened to your opposing viewpoints. We have managed so far to iron out our difficulties.
Mr. President, how is it possible for them to be ironed out when they are fundamentally opposed? Unless we have strong central government, we have nothing.
There will be no government at all, Mr. Hamilton, if it is operated at the expense of state rights.
Has it occurred to either of you gentlemen that it should be possible to have a strong central government to determine national policy and state government to preserve state rights in all matters of local nature?
That is as it should be, Mr. President. But it cannot be if the administration's policy includes Mr. Hamilton's partiality to certain groups.
I object to that.
Gentlemen, you will kindly refrain from allowing your personal passions to become involved in matters of state.
Mr. Jefferson has the opinion, Mr. President, that the common man, the farmer, the mill hand, and the peddler comprise the salt of the earth.
You have stated my position very fairly, Mr. Hamilton.
It is fallacious. Give the power of government into their hands, and the result is anarchy. You cannot give democracy such free scope. It must be dominated by a firm central government.
Gentlemen, we shall get nowhere with such a discussion. Each of you, as secretary of a department, is efficient, progressive, and valuable. We must take time to evolve the proper balance of power between the central and state government, and to work out the multitude of details which must arise with the formation of a new nation.
True, Mr. President. Yet, unless we can come to agreement on some of these problems...
Mr. Jefferson, you have consistently opposed everything I've attempted since my entrance into the cabinet.
Not everything, Mr. Hamilton. Perhaps we should have fewer disputes if the Secretary of the Treasury confined his activities to his own department.
Gentlemen, you will be gracious enough to sacrifice any personal animosities to the cause of establishing your country's government. I trust implicitly in each of you and in the sincerity of your political philosophies. I need you, and so does your government. I shall have to ask you both to banish from your minds any intention of tendering a resignation. That is all, gentlemen.
Both Jefferson and Hamilton, caught up by the almost insoluble problems of the day, threatened more than once to resign from office. Each time, deferring to the president's request, they reconsidered and remained to continue the fight. Finally, in 1793, at the age of 50, Jefferson retired from public life and returned to Monticello to attend to his private affairs, which partly because of heavy debts which had been transferred to him with his wife's estate, were in desperate need of attention. But he was not to remain in retirement for long. In 1796, he was elected vice president to serve under his old friend, John Adams. His term was comparatively uneventful, though it ended in dramatic events which broke up a deep friendship of long standing. The exciting election of 1800, Jefferson and Aaron Burr received an identical number of votes. The House of Representatives chose Jefferson. And now it was March 4th, 1801, the day of the first presidential inauguration in the partially completed Capitol at Washington. Former office holders and aspiring newcomers crowded the doors of the Senate chamber.
You're still here in Washington, Henry?
Well, why shouldn't I be, George?
Well, with Adams out and Jefferson in.
Well, how about yourself? You're in the same predicament. Out go the Federalists and in come the Republicans.
Out go some of them, Henry.
Hey, see here. Perhaps you've heard the same rumor that I have.
Perhaps. What's yours?
Well, I may continue as an office holder despite the change of chief executives. In fact, I'm quite certain of it.
You don't say.
Secretary of State Marshall was up until midnight making out commissions for Federalists. Certain Federalists, that is, to continue in office under Mr. Jefferson.
Apparently, Mr. Adams intends to keep his party in power even after he's left the presidency.
Why, certainly, and why not? Everything for the party.
And you think you're one of the Federalists who will continue in Mr. Jefferson's Republican administration?
I'm quite sure of it. At least, that's the rumor that I've heard.
Very interesting indeed. Want to know a secret?
You ever hear of a politician who didn't?
Well, here it is. I've heard the same rumor about myself.
No.
I think I'm staying, too.
Well.
Here comes Mr. Jefferson.
Walking from his boarding house to his inauguration.
A man who believes in sticking to his principles. Simplicity. Democracy.
Yes. I remember he once said something to the effect that he would remain always chiefly in the character of a farmer.
You know, I feel rather sorry for him, surrounded by a lot of us hostile Federalists. Office holders?
Better not count your chickens before they hatch.
Perhaps not. But even if they do hatch, they may get thrown out of the nest. There's Madison joining Mr. Jefferson. Probably the best friend he's got right now.
Undoubtedly will be his Secretary of State.
Good morning, Mr. Jefferson.
Oh, Madison. A pleasure to see you here. Will you accompany me into the Senate chamber?
Thank you.
Have you seen Mr. Adams about?
Mr. Adams? What, haven't you heard?
Heard?
He's not to be here for your inauguration.
Well, I don't understand. It's customary for the retiring executive to attend the inaugural of his successor.
It is the custom, yes, but it has been broken. Mr. Adams left Washington at daybreak in his carriage on his way home to Massachusetts.
Bitter thing for Jefferson, and for Adams, too, this breaking of a long friendship. Jefferson deprived of the honor of having his inaugural witnessed by his former friend and president, took the oath of office and began his term as chief executive. Finding himself surrounded by the Federalists, who had been given their offices without his approval, he made removals until he had established a balance between his opponents and followers. He conducted the affairs of state with the least possible show and ceremony, was re-elected by popular vote for a second term. In 1809, after almost 40 years of public service, during which his personal fortune had suffered severe reverses, he retired for the rest of his life to Monticello.
I never tire of this glorious view, Father. No wonder artists are always clamoring to do scenes of Monticello. I think we should have a view of you done, Father, sitting here amid...
No, I think we should not. Besides, my dear, how would I pay for one when my chief object now is to find a purchaser for Monticello?
What were you mooning about?
I was thinking I ought to get an answer to my letter to John Adams today. That is, if he wishes to reestablish our friendship as much as I do.
Oh, I'm sure he does. Sam hasn't brought up the post yet. He should be here in a minute. Oh, there's someone at the door now. But it isn't Sam. Some gentlemen.
See what they want, my dear.
I will. Oh, I see. As you come in. They wish to explain their visit to you alone, Father. I leave you.
Will you be seated, gentlemen?
Thank you, sir. Mr. Jefferson.
Thank you, sir.
To what do I owe your visit?
Mr. Jefferson, we know of the sale of your library of 10,000 volumes to the Library of Congress to help meet your financial difficulties.
Yes, and about how you stood behind a friend and got carried down by his financial losses.
Well, I don't understand.
You will not deny, Mr. Jefferson, that with a state's necessity to tax land heavily to make up for the strain of two wars, your vast estate is more of a burden than an investment.
My economic condition is poor indeed, gentlemen, but I don't see what...
Mr. Jefferson, you have a great many friends in this country. A popular subscription has been underway, and already the proceeds amount to a sum which will allow you to...
A subscription? For me?
A gift from the heart of the people, Mr. Jefferson.
It is only what is due you for your service to the country, sir. For your tireless work in the public interest.
To say nothing of your educational interest, and to be sure, without your help, the University of Virginia would never have been founded.
You dare not refuse the gift, Mr. Jefferson. It has been made by people who love and honor you.
Gentlemen, I'm overwhelmed.
Then we may announce your willingness to accept the gift?
In the deepest gratitude, yes.
Well, we must leave you for the present, sir. A more suitable presentation will be made later.
Yes. Good day, gentlemen.
Good day.
I heard what they said, Father. How gratifying to know how deeply you are loved by your people.
It is the kind of gratitude that knows no expression, my dear. Why are you smiling?
The post came. A letter from Mr. Adams.
A letter from John Adams.
He would not have written if he had not wished to renew his friendship with you, Father.
Oh, no, you're quite right. It is like a warm hand clasp across the miles. I must read it at once. This is a day I shall never forget, Martha. The whole world has suddenly opened up again.
The friendship of Jefferson and Adams, once reestablished, continued for many years. Though they never again saw each other, they corresponded frequently, and in their exchange of ideas forgot the differences which had grown out of their efforts to establish firmly the government of the young nation they headed. Thomas Jefferson lived to be 83 years old, surrounded by a devoted family, honored among statesmen, admired by scientists, artists, and educators, revered by a nation. He died on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, a few hours before the death of John Adams. He himself wrote the inscription for his tombstone. Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, of the Statute for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia.
Highlights from the life of Thomas Jefferson, one of the great Americans who have been honored by representation in the Hall of Fame at New York University. This was another of the American Portraits series. For dramatic purposes, certain liberties were taken with historical fact. The character of Thomas Jefferson was portrayed by Carl Benton Reed. The script, based upon material from the Dictionary of American Biography and other standard works, was written by Raymond Scudder. The narrator was Graham McNamee. Joseph Honte directed the orchestra. Harriet Beecher Stowe will be the subject of the next American Portrait. This is an educational feature of the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City.